We're going to come to a passage that providentially I think is going to speak to a lot of maybe what we've been feeling this week. Jesus has just finished his prayer. And when you think of Jesus, his closest friend is John. And that's who's writing this gospel. And then if you think of his closest three, that's Peter, James, and John. And then you think about the closest 12, you know, it's the 12 disciples. And this is a hard passage. We're only going to look at 11 verses. But what happens and what's your response when someone you thought you knew doesn't do what you thought they would do? And even though Jesus knows all things, he still went through a betrayal here. He went through someone turning his back. And so the question is, what does Jesus do? How does he respond to not just a betrayal from his friend, but an arrest? What is he trying to communicate to us as we've seen the pictures, right? You've seen the videotapes. You've seen the power of a storm, the power of wind, the power of water. And we feel small. We feel fragile. And what do you do when cages have been rattled in ways they haven't been in a long time? So we're going to look at John 18. And this is Jesus just finished praying and the betrayal and the arrest. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who had betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen because he is God and he knows everything, went out and asked them, "Who is it you want?" And Jesus of Nazareth, they replied, "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. All right, so Jesus sees his buddy Judas with this, you know, group of Roman soldiers. And he's realizing, okay, it's happening. And when he begins to talk about himself, you see Jesus what? He refers to himself. He says, "I am he." But that's in the English translation. But in the Greek translation, it's just this. It's just, he says, "I am." That's the only thing he says. It's not, he doesn't, I mean, for us to understand the kind of the subject-noun agreement thing. But really what it was is just, he said, "I am." Now, if you were a Jew in that time and you thought of the word "I am," you immediately went to, oh my goodness, remember Moses? And God appeared to Moses at the burning bush, and he said, "Go to Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh, let my people go." Moses says, "Who should I tell Pharaoh? Who should I tell Pharaoh who sent me?" And what does God say? God says, "Tell Pharaoh, I am sent you." Just the Hebrew verb to be. John 8 did this a few months ago. Jesus referred to himself. He talked about, he said, "Before Abraham, I am." Jesus what? Jesus has taken the divine name upon himself. And this is crazy. This is astonishing. When you think about Jesus saying, "I just am," what does that mean? He is saying this: I do not have a beginning and I do not have an end. A human is saying that. Someone literally said, I am. I never had a beginning, and I've never had an end. What would you say? What would you think if someone told you that? Oh, really? That's neat. Okay. Good. All right. I do not depend in my being on anyone. Every second, every person, all things in their being, they are dependent upon me. What? Who says this kind of stuff? This is crazy. And so when a living, breathing human being, Jesus, takes that name upon himself, it's a problem. it's a problem for us. It's a problem for our culture. Because he is saying what? Jesus is saying something in this moment that no other founder of any of the other major religions have ever said. Islam, right? Buddhism, all the other big ones, no one has ever said the stuff that Jesus is saying right now. In fact, he's saying the exact opposite of what every other founder of major religion has said. Because they all said what? They said, I'm a prophet. I'm a sage, right? They say things like, this is the way to truth, right? That's what Muhammad said. This is the way to truth. This is the truth. I've come to bring you the truth. That's what the other major founders of religion say, not Jesus. Jesus has the audacity to say this, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I've not come to show you how to find God. I am the uncreated, right? I am the beginningless God that came to find you. How you like that now? What? You know, they all say, I've come to show you the way to God, every other. And Jesus says, no, I am God. Come in the flesh. Come to find you, because you will never find me unless I come after you. That's what Jesus is saying. And it is utterly different and utterly opposed to any of the other major founders. What do you do with that? And I tell you what, in America, this is a problem. This is a problem verse, because our world says, when we talk about religion, we say, our Western paradigm says this, all the different religions, including Christianity, are very good. All of them are good. They meet major needs, and they're all just kind of sitting there, and you just kind of decide which ones you want. They're all good, and they wouldn't say Christianity's bad. They would say it was good. And you get to pick what's best for you, but Jesus will not let that happen. He will not let that happen to Christianity, because he says, I'm coming to get you. And here's the hard part. Christianity has to be superior if Jesus is right. But if he's wrong, Jesus is a loony tune. He is, or he's just a maniacal liar. That's who Jesus is. And so when you think, okay, Jesus saying Christianity is superior to any other religion, our world doesn't like that at all. In fact, we will get so much response to that. We will be called intolerant. We will be called absolutely exclusive in an inclusive society. What do you do? And when you really read his writings, if you look at these types of statements, you should despise him. You should despise Jesus. You can't find his teachings inspiring when he says stuff like this. It's impossible. And so, I don't know if you've had people come up to you, but I sure have, that says, well, I don't know if Jesus is actually the Son of God, but I love the teachings of Christianity. What does that prove? You've never read the Bible. I mean, that just shows that they've really never studied the Bible or read the writings of Jesus, because you couldn't say that about Jesus because of what he says. And so, do you know that in certain parts of Scripture, here's a quote, he says, I keep sending prophets and sages to you over the centuries, and you kill them all. Jesus said that. Jesus said, I sent you guys, the history of the world, prophets and sages over the centuries, and you know what you did? You killed them. I mean, who says that kind of thing? There's a place where Jesus says this, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven. Where were you? Who are you? Jesus says that. That is not a warm fuzzy. You know, that's like, where were you when I saw him fall? Because I know everything. I never started. I'm never going to end. And so either he is who he said he is, and that has to make Christianity a superior religion, or he's not who he said he is, and it's an inferior religion. There's two options. He will not sit on the shelf with all the rest. That's what he's saying here. He comes strong in 18 with this claim, right? This is a solid claim. You cannot say Christianity is okay. In fact, one of our, I would say, contemporary cultural icons, Bono, gave us this quote when he studied the works of Jesus. Jesus isn't letting you off the hook. The scriptures don't let you off the hook so easily. When people say, you know, good teacher, prophet, really nice guy, this is not how Jesus thought of himself. So you're left with a challenge in that, which is either Jesus was who he said he was, or a complete and utter nutcase. You have to make a choice on that. And I believe that Jesus was, you know, the Son of God, you know. Right? He read it. You can't. I mean, there's not a third option. And so when he makes these claims, right? If you decide he's right, what do we have to do? We have to fall on our knees. We have to commit to him and say, Jesus, my King, command me what to do. And then we build our entire life around him. Or if you decide he's wrong, you should have nothing to do with Jesus. If he's not who he said he was, have nothing to do with him. You should not want to read his writings or read his teachings, or you can't find him inspirational at all. In fact, you might have utter disdain for him because this guy is either a wacko or he is a liar. You cannot say the one thing that has no integrity at all is to say, I kind of like Jesus. He's kind of inspiring to me. I kind of like his teaching. I come to church every so often. I pray every so often. To, in this tepid way, respond to Jesus Christ means what? Either you're not thinking or you're not listening. You don't have intellectual integrity when you see him this way, because you really don't know. You don't know who he is, or you're just projecting onto Jesus who you want him to be. And that is a false Jesus. And so here's Jesus who makes the claim. I am he, the most unreasonable claim ever. He drops that bomb on us. Here's the greatest claim in all of history. Next verse. When Jesus said, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Now that may seem, all right, what's the big deal about this? When you're talking about a group of soldiers, right? The Greek word for detachment actually would mean like a troop. And these are imperial troops, Roman soldiers, like the baddest Navy SEALs of the day, 200 of them. They come with what? They come with Judas to go arrest the insurrectionists. That's what they came to do. Now, this would be about 200 Roman soldiers. And here is this, quote, meek, mild little rabbi. And here are the tough guys coming. And they would be like jacked up and maybe had a couple of Uzis or whatever, I don't know. But if you look at this, Jesus stands up, and in a kind of moment where he flicks on the light for everybody and then flicks it right off, he says, I am he. I am God. I am the Alpha and the Omega. And what happens? Roman soldiers fall to the ground. They're down. 200 Roman soldiers. He just says, I am God. Boom, they're down. Are you kidding me? I mean, we don't really look at these passages and see, like, what's the significance. The significance is that nobody can stay on their feet in the presence of God. Nobody. You look through all of Scripture. Everybody loses their footing in the presence of God. Ezekiel 1, God appears and speaks to Ezekiel. He's knocked flat. 2 Chronicles 5. They've just dedicated the temple, and the Shekinah glory enters into the temple. What do the priests and the ministers do? Down. Peter realizes who Jesus is in Luke 5 after this great miraculous catching of all these fish. Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, and he falls over at his feet. Isaiah comes into the presence of God and says, woe to me. Who am I? Who am I? And if you look at the Hebrew of who am I, it says, I am undone, which actually means this. In the presence of God, I come apart. I absolutely come apart. And so Jesus here, he claims what? He claims this ridiculous statement, I am God. And then in the next verse, he gives us a massive problem. And that's this, nobody can stand on their feet before God. In this moment, Jesus is flexing a little bit, right? Showing a little tricep, boom, right? Because before he lays his glory aside, right? Before he goes to the cross, he shows who he really is. And he says he's God and these guys are down. That's all he has to do. He looks at Irma. What? Irma? That's nothing. What are you talking about? I control everything. Nobody can stand on their feet before God because even just a glimpse, when you get the presence of something that is what? Infinitely bigger and greater than you, you are knocked off your feet. And so on Friday night at 2 a.m., when I saw that weather report, I felt things I'd never felt before. I got nervous, like thinking about my house and my family and my church and this whole community. And I was like, dude, this thing, I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't know at that level that I've felt that probably since Hurricane Charlie went over my house in Orlando. And I went to Lowe's. That's what you do, right? You get nervous, you go to Lowe's. So it's 5:30 in the morning. It's 5, it's 2. I didn't sleep at all. It's 5:30 in the morning. I pull into the Lowe's parking lot at Waters because it opens at 6 a.m. At 5:30, I'm number 100 in line. And by the time that baby opens, it's all the way to the Target. Because at that moment, I felt small and nervous, and so did everybody else. And we did not have control. Our footing was being lost. We became nervous. Yesterday, I'm at Keystone Little League, and I'm sitting there at the tee, warming guys up, throwing a little soft toss and putting balls on a tee. And all of a sudden, I turn to my right, and I'm like, oh, hey. And this is Kevin Cash, the manager of the Rays. He's coming to see his son. And I just got really nervous throwing soft toss as this guy just walked right by me. And I know a couple people that know him, and I shook his hand. And I was very insecure about just putting a ball on a tee or throwing soft toss because I'm like, hope I'm doing that right. I don't know. In the presence of, hey, something big or something that is way above you, we feel small and we begin to lose our footing. And when you, what? If you get into this current and it's too swift for you and you lose your footing, you will die. And if you're in a battle and the enemy is too strong, you're swept away. And when Jesus is writing this, he says in Ephesians 6, it says, put on the whole armor of God and having done all to stand. Because if you don't know much about battle or ancient battle, what's the big deal? You put on your armor and you're standing. What's it really trying to say? Is that ultimately, if you're standing at the end of the battle, you've probably won. And in the presence of a God, nobody, the true God, nobody has footing. You cannot stand, and that's a problem. And that is a little cherry bomb Jesus is dropping right here. The Roman soldiers couldn't stand. What are you going to do? What does Jesus then say? Hey, what is the solution to this? Because most people think religious things, or actually I don't hear more about religious people. I hear more about, I'm into spirituality. Spirituality is a good thing. I want to be spiritual. I'm a spiritual person. But if you begin to peel that onion, what happens? Is they say, hey, God's this divine presence. He's this divine spirit of love. And spirituality means I'm in tune, right, with spiritual feelings, warm, wonderful, inspiring. I'm kind of there. And Bible says no, because if you really were coming into contact with the presence of God, you don't have those feelings. You are struck by how small you are. You are struck by how immoral you are. You are struck by all the insecurities there. Because you know what? When we get knocked over, why we get knocked over is because our self-image, what? It's based on performance. It's based on how, hey, Frank, how big is your church? How long have you been at that church? And you've been at that church, so how big are you? Or how deep is your church? What is the performance metric? Are you able to, hey, I'm a decent person, I'm a good mother, I'm a good father, I'm a decent chap. Here's the money I've made, here's the place that I graduated from, right? Here are the talents that I have. But the problem is talk to somebody the day after they lost a job. Why do they seem fundamentally different? They're dealing with identity. Who am I without a job? If someone, hey, who am I if I'm not a mom? If I've lost a child, who am I? Who am I if I can't provide for my family? And then when this begins to happen, man, I tell you what, we fracture. And so when you have to live with people and work with somebody that's better looking, right? That's brighter than you, that's more talented than you. It becomes to be, kind of feels traumatic. And your self-image begins to collapse. And we begin to think, you know what? Why does that guy have that girlfriend? I thought she would like me. I guess I'm not that. Maybe I am just an overweight junior higher. Or I'm just the nerd high schooler. I thought I was cooler than that, but I can tell I'm not being invited. No one texts me. I don't get invited to these parties, right? That driveway party over there, man, all those people, I'm never invited. What do I need to do? Do I not make enough money? Am I not cool? I mean, like, what? And things begin to, break apart. And so when you think about God, you cannot think about God as a warm fuzzy, because when you're in the presence of God, you cannot stand. And common sense doesn't say that, you know? Common sense doesn't necessarily say you can't stand in front of God until you experience that. And I think what happens is when you begin to think about Irma and the weight of that and how our lives could have utterly been transformed. I mean, on that Saturday or that Sunday morning, you know, into Monday, we could have, you know, lost our houses, lost our loved ones. Some people have. But what do you do with that? What do you do with the greatness of just a hurricane or the thought of an impending nuclear war? I mean, what do you do? You don't have handles for that. And our world begins to lose our footing. And ultimately, here's what the scriptures say. The scriptures say that, you know what? In the presence of the glory of God, which is ultimately pointing to the presence of a judge, because all of the scriptures are pointing us to this day, right? Kind of the judgment day. Like the day when we're going to have to count for our lives. And if you took the Ten Commandments, right? And that was the standard by which you would be judged. And you're going to have to give account. You're going to have to be able to stand up in that, you know, in that courtroom and account for your life and meet the standard. We will all be flat on our face. Because when the judge judges you by his standards, we cannot stand at all in that judgment day. And when you think about Jesus Christ, who what? He was veiling his glory. He was about to lay aside his glory. If we couldn't stand before him and keep our feet, how will we ever stand before him if we ever really meet him? The answer is, on that day, we will not. We can't. And that's the great problem of the human race, is that we will not be able to meet that standard. And that is the problem. He gave us he basically made a statement, and then Jesus, on that very next act, he created a massive problem for us. And so, obviously, the rest of the passage, what's the solution? What's the solution to this problem? If no one can stand Jesus, if you showed me that 200 Roman soldiers are going to be knocked out, please tell me there's going to be a solution. Please tell me you're going to fix this. And so, Jesus, again, he asked them, who is it you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they said. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go. Who is he talking about? If you're looking for me, Jesus says, I want you to do what? I want you to take these disciples and I want you to let them go. Because I know if you think I'm a revolutionary, if you think I'm an insurrectionist, what you would normally do in this society is take all of his henchmen too. Not just the ringleader, you take all his henchmen. And here's what Jesus says. He says, look, I want you to take me. It's me you want. You've told me you're seeking me. Then what? Then let them go. If you really look at that phrase in the Greek, it's a phrase that means forgive them and take me. Forgive them, take me. Which leads us to the next obvious thing, and that's The Last of the Mohicans, the movie, obviously. Because there's this awesome scene that completely illustrates this. Daniel Day-Lewis, Hawkeye, is in love with Korra. And Duncan is also in love with Korra. And he's the British officer. The problem is they've just been captured by the Huron Indians. This is during the French and Indian War. So there's the three of them. And here is Hawkeye and Duncan and Korra. And I want to make sure I get this right. And so everybody in that scene, except for Hawkeye, knew French, the language French. The language French. The French language. Once they've been taken, the chief, who speaks in French, says, Korra must die in French. Hawkeye can't understand French. She must burn in the fire for the sins of her family because of the things her father had done. The chief looks at Duncan and Hawkeye and says, you guys can go free. Korra's going to burn. Hawkeye, immediately upset, and he turns to the British officer, and they don't have a good relationship. There's tension, but they're all three captives. He turns to Duncan, and this is what Hawkeye says. Tell him in French, take me for her. Duncan then turns and says something in French that Hawkeye doesn't understand. The chief looks at him, and Hawkeye says to Duncan, did you tell him? Right? Duncan turns to Hawkeye and says, yes. All of a sudden, the chief nods, and the warriors give Korra to Hawkeye. And they grab Duncan, and they throw Duncan in the fire. I don't know if you've ever seen that scene, but he's burned at the stake. It's an unbelievable scene. You don't realize it because you kind of are set up to not like Duncan. But in this heroic gesture, he goes, no, I see this. I see what needs to be done. And no, I'm going to tell you, Hawkeye, that I did this, but I didn't. They're going to take me. And you guys are going to live. And when you think about this passage right here, and you think about what Jesus says to these soldiers, he says, okay, wait a minute. Jesus, I mean, you might say when you think about this, okay, Jesus is just saving those 12 people by giving himself to the soldiers. What about the rest of us? And the answer, ultimately, I'm going to have to read the rest of the text because it comes. Let's go to the next slide. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. Peter, man, wow. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me? The cup, right? All throughout the Old Testament, the cup is what? The cup is Judgment Day. The cup is what God is going to do to the tyrants. It's what he's going to make the tyrants drink. It's what he's going to make the oppressors drink on Judgment Day. And that day, he says, the cup is suffering and it's coming. The cup is punishment. It's judgments. It is justice. On Judgment Day, here's what the Old Testament says. All evildoers are going to drink from the cup. So what's Jesus saying here? He's saying this, I'm going to the cross. And on the cross, I'm going to have all of the judgment you deserve fall on me. Everything you deserve is going to fall on me. I will go into the fire for you. Problem, solution. Problem is you can't stand. Here is the solution. The secular world says this. Come on, Taylor. There is no judgment day. And all these injustices, they're never going to be rectified. It's kind of fatalism. Religious people, traditional religion says something like this. There will be a judgment day. The judge will be here, so you better be a good person. Here's what the gospel says. There's going to be a judgment day, but the judge came to earth and was judged in our place. Amen? Jesus Christ is the judge who was judged. What? Because he didn't want to lose any of you. That's how much he loves you. That is crazy that he would do this. Take me and let them go. I will take the judgment. So on judgment day, what? You can stand. You're going to stand on judgment day. And that's what the gospel says to you. And he says to me, it's a game changer. Do you know the implications that this could have on your life if you really believe this? I mean, you let this sink in. I mean, if this really did, if you would believe on judgment day, you would be able to stand and you would not lose your footing. That when tomorrow at work and someone criticizes you, you can hear that. And you won't lose your footing. You don't have to. You can say, wait a minute, who cares what they think of me in the lunchroom? Who cares about what they say about my body? About the words I use, about the stuff on my face, about, you know, the job that I have. I am not on trial anymore. The judge has been judged. I am not on trial. And the verdict has come in and it says, I am not guilty. That's what Jesus is saying to us. That's ridiculous that you are accepted. And if you know that on the last day you're going to stand and you will not be flattened, you can live differently. You will not lose your footing when you are criticized. And I think many of us, we've been rattled. And we feel small. And we have to be reminded, hey, look, Jesus showed us the problem. But he gave us the solution. No one can stand. I mean, look at a weatherman when Hurricane Irma comes, right? There's no way he can get any leverage, he can't tighten down anything. And Jesus said, no, all that's not even, I'm taking that whole hurricane on me. That should be on you. I've taken it on me. And you're going to be fine. And you are free. And so I don't even want to, I was looking at the passage hoping that there was nothing referring to Mary because it's too close to Marie, if you're looking at the hurricane track. But he says, you're free, right? You're free to go through a hurricane, maybe different with Marie. Let's say she comes. And let's say you are just rattled to your core because you forgot the gospel. You forgot that you will never lose your footing with Jesus. And so if Marie comes next week or whatever, hey, okay, no, I'm always going to ultimately stand. And that is freedom for us. And you know what? Here's the other thing. In our neighborhood, people aren't out a whole lot, but they were out a lot for the past week. And people are talking because they're rattled. The conversations were different. And I think our church and this community has an opportunity. I think people will want to speak to eternal things more readily right now. I think you have an opportunity not to just go and pick up some debris for some people and tie a garbage bag and put it at the side of the road for them or pull out a chainsaw. I mean, definitely do those things. But to say, hey, I just want you to know, I want to do these things, but the reason I want to do them is not just because I want us to have a great neighborhood or a community or whatever. I want to tell you about the security I have in my life because Hurricane Irma made me think about it. And I need to remember where my faith is, and it's not in a family, it's not in a home or a job, it's in a person, and it's Jesus. And I think you need to say it. You need to articulate your faith. Look for an opportunity this week to not just do a kind work, because there's lots of people doing kind works, and that's great. But tell them why you're doing a kind work, why you would help somebody. It's because somebody helped you when he didn't have to, and that's the gospel. What if we had our junior high school students do that? Hey, you know the reason that I can be secure and I'm still going through puberty? Because Jesus. You know the reason I know I'm not doing that great in my grades, but I don't find myself in my grades. I find them in Jesus. If I perform poorly, if I do whatever, if I make a mistake, I'm forgiven because it's Jesus. Control, a lot of it's been rattled and shaken, and I think that that's a good thing for us, particularly here, us who normally can pretty much control variables in our life pretty effectively. And you can't with a hurricane. You can't. It's too big. It's too powerful. It points us. It's a signpost to how great and awesome God is. So what do you do with this? How can this hurricane that's affected our community, how can God use it for his glory? How can your own fear point you to Jesus, right? I think we can be stronger, more courageous, more honest. Now, because of this passage and because of going through it together as a church. So let's pray and ask God that he would work in our lives. God, there's homes right now that you want to, you absolutely want to heal. God, there are communities you want to bring together. But Father, we don't want to be brought together from due to just a storm. God, communities are brought together for all kinds of reasons. Some tragedies, some it's a sports franchise, some it's a college affiliation. It's a particular way of life. But God, may we bring our community together through pointing our community to Jesus and saying, hey, he's the one. He's the only security. You want life insurance? That's life insurance. You want hazard insurance? That's hazard insurance. You want flood insurance? It's Jesus. May we, God, use our words with our actions to be fishers of men, as you call us to be, to bring people here next Sunday who might be a little bit more open to the gospel because their entire foundation has been rattled. And may we tell them, you can build it on sand if you want, but hey, I'm going to build my house upon the rock, and that's Jesus. So when the storms come, God, we will not be shaken. Help us do that. Help our unbelief, God. Thank you for this passage. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for him being the judge that was judged for us. In your name, amen.